Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
A three-judge panel of the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has handed a victory to environmental groups over a uranium mining ban on lands next to the Grand Canyon. The National Mining Association and related groups had asked the court to overturn the 20-year moratorium that was put in place in 2012 by then-Interior Secretary Ken Salazar. Kevin Dahl, Arizona Program Manager for the National Parks Conservation Association, joins me with his perspectives on the ruling and what could be next. Kevin, you're obviously pleased with the ruling, but what were your biggest worries about the ban possibly being lifted?
Drilling for uranium near the Grand Canyon happens in a very complicated, complex aquifer. The underground water there is not well known, and we're afraid that it's contaminated by these uranium mines. The water supplies the unique seep springs and side canyons of the Grand Canyon, and it also supplies the only water source for the Havasupai Indians who live at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. So we're concerned that this is the wrong place to mine for uranium until a lot more is known about the underground aquifer, and that's why the moratorium was put in place, so that we can find out what sort of impacts it might have. It's a precautionary measure, very important, not only to the Grand Canyon's water supplies, but, you know, that drains into the Colorado River, which supplies 40 million people, you know, L.A., Las Vegas, Phoenix. It's real important that area, this most iconic landscape, the sacred landscape, be protected forever.
And when you mention iconic, this becomes less a legal question for me and more a philosophical one. So many people from around the world visit the Grand Canyon. Almost everyone knows what the Grand Canyon is. Does that play in a part, obviously not in the Ninth Circuit ruling, but just in terms of its importance? This is such an iconic place in America that the idea of uranium mining gives a lot of people a stomachache, even those who are not involved in the environment on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I think so. And when this issue is put to the test, when people are polled, should we have uranium mines near the Grand Canyon? Republicans, Democrats, Independents, almost everybody says no. Now, that's the purpose of my organization. You think national parks like Grand Canyon are perfectly protected, but they're not. The people have ideas to do things near them or in them that are inappropriate. You know, there's not a whole lot of national parks. There's 59 of them in the country, and they deserve the most important protection. We shouldn't be uranium mining near them. We shouldn't be fracking for oil or gas near them. Yet that's what's happening on public lands near our national parks.
Kevin, let's talk about the congressional hearing that was held, which also involved Arizona Representative Paul Gosar. It's the House Natural Resources Subcommittee on Energy and Mineral Resources. It seemed that they attacked the ruling when they had an opportunity to. What did you make of the hearing, and what did you hear from it? What was your perception?
Well, the hearing was held, as part of the Trump administration's program to remove burdens from public lands in the production of energy and other resources. This committee subcommittee was looking at other mineral withdrawals, but the uranium one at the Grand Canyon is one of them. So, yeah, Representative Paul Gosar thinks we should mine uranium there. Congressman Raul Grijalva, who's the ranking member, the minority member, also from Arizona, strongly believes that we shouldn't. So it received an hearing. The lobbyist for the American Mining Association thinks that we should mine near the Grand Canyon. However, there was a tribal council member from Havasupai who gave a very eloquent presentation about her homeland, how the water is so important to them, and that the land and the water should not be polluted.
There is the perception, and this is obviously on one side of the political aisle, that the Ninth Circuit is too progressive, too liberal. That's been going on for a very long time. Does that indicate anything to you about where the next step is? I presume the opponents of the Ninth Circuit ruling are going to try to take this up to the highest court, to the Supreme Court. Any concerns about that?
The mining companies who have the right to appeal this to the Supreme Court, we suspect they won't, because the ruling is pretty clear. The district court was very clear. They're consistent between the circuit and the district court. It doesn't seem that they have much basis for appeal. And despite political leanings, one hopes that the courts are fair. But our lawyers are pretty sure that they won't. Our bigger concern is that the Trump administration or Congress will decide to attack this moratorium. And we really hope that they don't. The moratorium is to collect more information. Let's collect more information, and down the road we can revisit this decision. That seems like the most reasonable thing to do at this time.
Kevin Dahl is Arizona Program Manager for the National Parks Conservation Association.
The Food and Drug Administration this week launched a new campaign to try to get smokers to quit. The Every Try Counts campaign will target smokers between the ages of 25 and 54 who have unsuccessfully tried to kick the habit in the last year and will be shown near where people buy their smokes. Joining me to talk about this is Wayne Tormala, Chief of the Bureau of Tobacco and Chronic Disease at the State Department of Health Services. And Wayne, first off, what do you make of this new campaign?
Well, I've been looking at the campaign, and I think it's we certainly welcome every effort that's out there to help Arizonans quit smoking. And the fact that Every Try Counts, this theme, certainly resonates with how we look at people who use tobacco in Arizona, that we know that 7 out of 10 smokers want to quit, and most of them have tried several times. And we also know that when you talk to people who have quit smoking, you know, there's everything under the sun. So everything from cold turkey, talking to your doctor, your family, calling the ASH line, that all works. And so I like the personal approach that you're trying to get into, like customizing for the smoker that might say, well, I tried this and I tried that and it didn't work. But here's something that you're giving me some more options. That's good.
Are there fewer people smoking in Arizona now than there have been in years past?
Oh, yeah. We've dramatically reduced smoking in Arizona. Just in the last 5 years, we've gone from a 19.5% rate, and that's 19.5% of Arizona adults say that they've used tobacco in the last 30 days, to 14, and now we're at 14.7. So when you run that data across the census data, it's approximately 200,000 fewer smokers. So we feel really good about that.
Are public health officials at the point now where sort of the low-hanging fruit has been picked, so to speak, that you've stopped people who, you know, were sort of maybe on the fence about smoking from starting, and the people who really wanted to quit and were really committed to quitting have quit already, and now you're trying to reach this population that, you know, maybe still wants to quit but is having a harder time following through or having a harder time actually doing it?
Actually, you're spot on with from our playbook in terms of we know that most people who use tobacco now are entrenched. Certainly, you know, most of them are addicted because of the nicotine, and we know they've tried several times. So when you say there's no more low-hanging fruit, that's quite true. I mean, that's how we see it. So if you're smoking today, it's not that you don't know that there are hazards, you know, that there are you're more prone to disease, a shorter lifespan. And also the cost. I mean, people know that it's very expensive to be a smoker these days. So the fact that there's no low-hanging fruit, and that's how we approach getting people to reduce and stop smoking, is looking at populations that may be smoking at higher rates, looking at are there new ways we can approach folks. And to this degree, that's where the FDA campaign can be quite useful, I think. I think they're trying some, you know, looking at social media, looking at apps on the phone, that kind of thing. New methods that might reach people who have tried before unsuccessfully.
Well, given, as you say, though, that, you know, most people who smoke know that there are health risks, some fairly severe health risks. They know about the costs. They, in many cases, have maybe either tried to quit or want to quit. Does the fact that they're still smoking, given all of that, indicate that maybe a public education campaign isn't going to be terribly effective?
Yeah, we know there's always a certain amount of the population out there that'll respond to, like, public education. So if we're doing TV ads, radio ads, that kind of thing, that people will see that and respond. Sometimes you're sending a message to a person just at a pivotal moment. Maybe there's something else happening in their life. We're coming up on New Year's, so there's New Year's resolution time. It's a good time to say, well, here's the time where we all examine our lives and how do we want to make some improvements. So maybe it's an achievable moment for folks. So we know that, you know, some people receive that message, but also then we're looking at, you know, how do we put the messaging in places where people, the work, you know, where they live, where they play, you know, in their faith communities, in their social circles, you know, what can we do to sort of normalize not smoking? And I think, you know, some people have you know, all of a sudden they see the cost. They're worried about the economy. They know that a pack-a-day smoker might spend up to $3,000 a year to support that habit. And looking at the health. So there's a lot of key decision points, I think, that we can appeal to get people to stop smoking.
Is this new campaign from the FDA being done in conjunction with state agencies like yours at all?
Well, certainly it is here in Arizona. When we plan out our campaigns, you know, we'll look at any other campaigns, especially national campaigns that might be coming in. So the Centers for Disease Control, you know, they might be launching a campaign. In this case, the FDA is, and they've notified us that, you know, we certainly know that we're one of the states that they're going to be airing their ads in. So we will plan our marketing accordingly. So we'll look at the dark times. We'll look at the time when maybe FDA isn't running their ads, and that's when we'll run our ads. So as much as possible, we try to get surround sound effect with our marketing, so the message is almost constantly out there.
All right. Wayne Tormala is Bureau Chief of Tobacco and Chronic Disease at the Arizona Department of Health Services. Wayne, thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks, Mark. Really appreciate it.
Good morning. It's the show. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein and Todd Zwillick at our partner, The Takeaway.
I've said it before. Alabama has been at a crossroads. We have been at crossroads in the past. Yes. And unfortunately, we have usually taken the wrong fork. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, you took the right road.
Democrat Doug Jones shocked Alabama, shocked the country with a victory over Republican Roy Moore last night. Moore hasn't conceded the Senate race just yet, but now this contest is fodder for Democrats, wondering if they have a new model to win in red places. And for Republicans who nominated and stuck with a candidate who couldn't win in a state, giving him every possible conservative advantage.
Pat Duggins is news director for Alabama Public Radio. He's been with us every step of the way in this race. Pat, thanks for coming back, as always.
Thank you, Todd. Thanks for having me on.
Well, a political shocker by any measure. What's the reaction in Alabama to Democrat Doug Jones winning this race?
Well, if you looked at the images coming from the Doug Jones camp, you had, you know, very, very happy African-American voters. And if you looked at the Roy Moore camp, you had very despondent old voters. So right now, we're just kind of waiting for the state to certify the vote, which could take maybe a week or so. And we'll just kind of see from there.
Pat, you said on this program a couple of weeks ago, and you were quoting somebody there in Alabama, that if Roy Moore were to win this Senate race, it would prove that Alabamans can't be embarrassed. That didn't happen.
No, it didn't. And it's an interesting coalition that Doug Jones was able to bring together to make this happen, because if he just went just plain old-fashioned Democrat, it's very unlikely he would have beat Roy Moore. However, he was able to put together not only a huge African-American turnout, estimates upwards of 40% of the African-American electorate did turn out, which is kind of like hearkening back to when Barack Obama was running for president. And then you also had disaffected Republicans, a lot of those quote-unquote soccer moms in suburban areas around Birmingham and around Mobile, who simply just could not hold their nose anymore, considering all of the allegations of sexual abuse, child molestation against Roy Moore. And if you just look at the vote totals, somebody on the GOP side flipped. In fact, a lot of people on the GOP side flipped.
Well, let's talk about Roy Moore and the next couple of weeks. Roy Moore did not concede this race last night. He says more votes will be counted. John Merrill, who's the Secretary of State in Alabama, said it's highly unlikely the results will change, but Roy Moore says this isn't over.
Well, he didn't give up. However, there's several things that could happen. Under Alabama law, if the vote tally between the two top candidates is within 0.5%, there's an automatic recount. It looks as though Jones won by at least three times that, so an automatic recount may not happen. However, it is possible that Roy Moore could ask for an expensive recount that observers say he can't afford. However, the Federal Elections Commission just came out with a recent report saying that most of the money for Roy Moore's campaign, which was like maybe 1/5 of what Doug Jones had, was coming from outside. So ironically, you've got Roy Moore and Steve Bannon saying, we don't want those Yankee outsiders, blah, 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 you know, coming into Alabama and telling us what to do. And yet most of the monetary support from Roy Moore seemed to come from outside. If he can magically afford a recount, it'll be very interesting to trace the money and find out where those bucks came from.
And that would be reportable, right? You'd be able to trace that.
It would seem so.
Let's talk about Doug Jones and the campaign he ran, Pat Duggins. Did Doug Jones present a platform to Alabamans that you think they really got behind, or was he relying on the history, the comments, and the public profile of Roy Moore, who was so well known to Alabamans for so long.
He was criticized for not being specific. As I think I've mentioned before, one of his big things that he hangs his hat on is the fact that 40 years after the 1963 16th Street Baptist Church bombings, he as a U.S. attorney, was able to convict two members of the Ku Klux Klan for that attack, which made him, there was some Doug Jones signs out there saying, vote Doug Jones, Democrat, civil rights champion. It was a really, really big deal. But getting back to the criticism that Doug Jones was not specific on what he wanted to do, is possible what he was trying to do was avoid dog whistle issues that would send Republicans, oh, no, I can't believe he said that. I have to go off and vote for Roy Moore. He already is pro-choice. That's obvious. He's also, for example, in favor of DACA, the Dreamers bill that allows immigrant children a chance to stay in the United States. I mean, you know, Roy Moore was absolutely against DACA. He likes tax reform, but he's not necessarily going to give a blank check to the Republicans on their tax reform plan. He's pro-Obamacare. A lot of people in Alabama are anti-Obamacare. He likes the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms. He says he's a hunter. However, he says, okay, listen, there are certain limits that we could put in and make it work that way. If you go back to the Heller decision that was written by Antonin Scalia, even he said, look, everybody's got the right to bear arms, but there are certain limitations out there. It's like the freedom of speech. You can't, you know, you can say whatever you want to in the United States, but you can't libel someone and you can't go into a theater and yell fire. So that, even though Doug Jones is in favor of gun rights, again, limitations are okay with him. And perhaps the biggest thing in Alabama is he's pro-LGBT and Roy Moore was not. So there's a lot of stuff that Doug Jones liked that Roy Moore didn't like, and that may be why Jones was not talking an awful lot about what he stood for, because he didn't want to upset Republicans in Alabama.
Pat Duggan's news director for Alabama Public Radio. Pat, you've been with us since the beginning of this race. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Todd.
And that's Todd Zwillick at our partner, The Takeaway. A number of high-profile people in the world of entertainment have been accused of sexual misconduct, from Harvey Weinstein to Kevin Spacey to Louis C.K., and that's led to a lot of people questioning how to handle the work they've done and thinking about how or whether to watch their performances. To help us dig into that, we're joined by Tiffany Farrell, curator of exhibitions at Mesa Contemporary Arts at Mesa Art Center, and Matt Delmont, director of the School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies at ASU. And Tiffany, let's start with you and take a look at the big picture here. How should we, as the consuming public, handle the work that these people have done?
I think it depends. You know, I think there's different ways we treat things like living artists versus dead artists, if you will. Dead artists, you know, I think we have to analyze things as they are and use it for context. And living artists, if you will, I think we also have to take a step back. Right now, we're in the middle of a controversy. Highly emotional topics. The Me Too movement is in its height right now, and I think we can't make certain decisions until we know the ramifications and have a little bit of distance. And then there's things we can do. I mean, I think one of the first things we're doing right now is knocking these people off their pedestals. I think that's absolutely what we have to do first. But then the next, you know, level of it may need to figure out what is going to be helpful for people in the future, for especially the victims. Should their royalties be used for them? Should they go to court and then, you know, have civil process go through all of that? Because if you sit there and say, okay, Weinstein, we're not going to show any more of his movies anymore, what happens is you're not only affecting Weinstein, great, but you're affecting all the other people that have worked under him. So I feel like we have to be very careful in times like these right now.
Matt, what do you think?
I like a lot of what Tiffany said. I think particularly drawing distinctions between living artists and artists in the past. But for folks who are living, one of the things that's really struck me about the moment we're in right now is there's so much attention in the sort of public discourse to the actions they've taken. I think it's because so few of these cases actually go to court. Right, so I think it's being tried in the court of public opinion because that's one of the only places we can actually see it tried. I'm actually in more of a kind of rush to judgment mode, I think, than Tiffany is. I'm fine with people who have been accused of these things and reasonable people believing that the accusations are accurate, which I believe they are. they don't need to be in business any longer. Right? I think we can talk about the ramifications of what comes next. But for contemporary artists who are accused of some of these heinous acts, they can be put on the sidelines, right, until they have a chance to rehabilitate themselves, apologize, and sort of make amends. So I think actually for folks who've been found guilty of things and have a chance to sort of serve a term for what they've done, that actually makes me more comfortable that they've been held accountable. There's so many people in Hollywood right now who just are not being held accountable. If this is what it's going to take for consumers to kind of join together and boycott their work, I'm actually okay with that, a more hardline stance on that.
Tiffany, it's interesting what you said about how, for example, if people don't show Harvey Weinstein movies anymore, you're not just hurting him, you're hurting all the people who, you know, worked on those films. And in fact, you know, there's a lot of discussion about what the future, for example, of House of Cards would be once right. Kevin Spacey was fired from that show and all the allegations came out about him. And the decision was made that there would be one more year as planned, one more season of the show, but he would not be on it. Does that sort of seem like the way to maybe go, both from a media company perspective, but also maybe from a media consumer perspective?
Absolutely. I think that's an appropriate stance. And then it allows then for another conversation to happen. So I understand the lead female role is going to become more dominant. And I think that's a way of tackling the issue, you know, and it hopefully brings about a bit of satisfaction in a contemporary conversation on the dialogue and everything that's going on. I mean, for me, Bill Cosby is a huge deal too. I mean, granted, he is a predator, but his show had such an impact. Me as a white person watching the Cosby show, was all the shows that were out there on the media were negative portrayals of black people. And Bill Cosby brought to light, look, these are professionals. They're upper middle class people, and you can't discredit some of that positiveness that happened.
Matt, I actually wanted to bring up Bill Cosby. That's what I was thinking as well. When there's a greater cultural significance to something, because with Weinstein, people can watch movies or not, and they may or may not think of him as they're watching the movies. But Bill Cosby, in many cases, was the creator of the programs he did as well. When there's a greater cultural significance to it, when it feels like, as Tiffany posited there, that maybe this is the first positive example people saw of an African-American on TV, how does that affect things in a greater sense?
I think being able to talk about the context in which these works were created. So I think no one's ever going to take away the cultural significance of the Cosby Show in the 1980s. And in fact, Cosby's entire legacy as an entertainer, all of his groundbreaking roles. But at the same time, now every time we talk about it in the classroom, when it shows up in textbooks, when it's on Wikipedia, it's going to be couched in the context of he also, based on accusations, appeared to be a serial rapist, right? You can't separate these two things at this moment. So I think the kind of question going forward would be, with the Cosby Show, do we air reruns of it? Right? I think that's where you can hold the Cosby Show up to sort of say that it had this amazing cultural legacy, but we don't need to keep airing reruns of it, right? The Cosby Show, one of the good things it did in the 80s was it opened up the door to a lot more African-American programming. So we should have reruns of Rock and 227, right, in a different world, right? We can let the Cosby Show itself go while still having the sort of the two lines that say this was an important moment in American TV history and American African-American history.
Is it harder to think about, though? Because as you say, Bill Cosby did a lot of amazing things for African-Americans on TV and entertainment in general, but like, as a consumer, is it possible really to separate that? And maybe should we try to separate that out?
For myself as a consumer and also as a scholar, I don't separate them out. I think I'm always thinking about producers' works of art in the context in which they're produced and what kind of meaning went into it, what kind of people these people were, right? Doesn't mean they all need to be role models, but I want to share with my students what kind of person was this, right? I'm teaching Birth of a Nation, right? I want to be able to talk. I need to show the film, right? It's an important film, but also give the context of what W.D. Griffith was trying to achieve and where it sort of fit into American cultural history. With the Cosby Show, that one actually hurts personally, right? You watch it, so you identify with it. I was 10 at the time it came out, and I loved the show, right? To watch it now is creepy. But it's actually funny, going back and talking to my mom, these were not things that were – a lot of people shared these secrets, right? So she was a flight attendant. She talked to other flight attendants. They knew Bill Cosby was a creepy guy, right? That didn't come through on the TV series. But for people who were in the know, a lot of this sort of was going on under the radar. So for me, trying to watch a show, I can't watch it the same way now. It just doesn't read the same as a consumer. And I'm okay working through that and kind of letting that go, right? That aspect of my childhood can be gone and stay in the past and recognize that everything is a lot more complicated than it comes through on TV, I think.
Tiffany, I wanted to ask, though obviously this conversation is about artists, I wonder how we compare to some extent. If we think about political folks, if we look back in time, that there's talk that Woodrow Wilson, was he a racist? Or we go back to the Founding Fathers and this sort of thing. So just to put it into context, art is so important to many of us in terms of how we live our lives. And yet, in some ways, people would argue it doesn't necessarily directly affect us in terms of the moral choices that an artist makes may be less affecting to us than the moral choices that someone in politics makes. How do you think we balance that out?
Again, it just depends, you know, what you're doing. I mean, me as a curator, it just depends what the conversation I'm wanting to have. So I know a big deal was putting together the 9/11 museum. Huge deal was, well, how do you talk about the terrorists? You know, they're obviously a part of the equation. They put their image, if you've ever been to the 9/11 memorial, they actually have their images there and also showing some of the footage and stuff like that of when they were passing through the TSA. It was a huge criticism by the victims and the families of the victims, and they felt very strongly that those you're memorializing those people, you're giving them their own line in history. And but it's like, again, you can't sit there and say this just happened. You can't rewrite history. You can't rewrite the pains of history and what the wrong people have done. So I think they have a very valid spot in that art museum. You can say that about anything.
I think in a lot of cases, people will look at maybe books and literature and art a little differently than they would look at, for example, a TV show or movie, especially a sitcom and a movie. Going forward, though, do you think that maybe people will be studying popular culture, maybe The Cosby Show or House of Cards or whatever program it is going forward, the way that scholars have been looking at art and books to try to get a sense of what were things like at that time? What was the context in which this work was created?
So I think, yes, absolutely. And scholars are already doing this. What the academic term for it is extratextual. So things that appear outside of the film or outside of the book or outside of the TV series, and try to read that into the production itself. I think that's important because it actually gives you a more complicated and nuanced view of a film or TV show, right? So going back and trying to watch House of Cards now, it's going to be totally different the second time around. And going back to your initial question, one of my hopes of this moment is actually we'll create new creative possibilities, right? So for that show, they should have had Robin Wright's character be the lead on season two anyway, because Kevin Spacey's character was kind of played out after season one. Whatever he did off screen, he could have just been done after season one anyway. But I'm hopeful that getting rid of some of these bad characters who almost are exclusively men will actually open up more space for more female leads, more female directors, both film and TV, in better cultural productions.
Matt Delmont is the director of the School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies at ASU. We're also joined by Tiffany Farrell, curator of exhibitions at Mesa Contemporary Arts at Mesa Art Center. We'll hear more from them coming up in just a few minutes.
And we continue our conversation now about what to do about art that's produced by people accused of misconduct, be it TV, movies, or fine art. Our guests are Tiffany Farrell, curator of exhibitions at Mesa Contemporary Arts at Mesa Art Center, and Matt Delmont, director of ASU School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies at ASU. And Matt, let's look at the big picture. Do we think, based on how the public is responding, would there be more pressure, obvious or otherwise, by the public to have higher expectations of the artists? And if so, are we going to end up losing something there, since a lot of artists have done bad things, sexual misconduct or other criminal behavior, drug use or things like that? Do you see there being a chilling effect on some aspects of art?
So when I think about that, I do draw a distinction between bad behavior or self-harming behavior, so drug use, whether someone's difficult to work with, difficult personality, and illegal behavior and the kind of sexual harassment we're seeing. I'm okay, although I don't engage myself, I'm okay with the more self-harming behaviors or the difficult artists, that kind of behavior. I'm not okay at all with the sexual harassment and the legal behavior. And I think we're okay if we lose artists who might be great geniuses in other respects but are horrible people, right? They're treating other humans horribly. We can live without their art, right? There's plenty of films, plenty of TV shows, plenty of books, plenty of works of art that we can still enjoy and critique and discuss in museums and in our classrooms. We can live without those folks. I'm actually okay with that being a chilling effect if it holds people accountable. I think ideally, the next generation, if people see people losing their livelihoods, losing their stature because they were actually held accountable for this for the first time in decades, that might actually get people to behave differently.
I think you just leave it for people to decide. I think we have to be very careful because I think it can be a form of censorship, being censoring of content. It just all depends on the conversation you're using to have. I mean, if you're using it to showcase, you know, look, this is unacceptable behavior, this is an artist, and I do think we should not show, you know, definitely put these people on a pedestal, but I don't think we should destroy anything either.
Is there a danger that if we continue to, for example, watch Harvey Weinstein's movies or watch House of Cards or eat at Mario Batali's restaurants, for example, are we even subconsciously or maybe implicitly, I don't want to say condoning their behavior because I don't think anybody would do that, but in some way saying it's not okay, but it's not the worst thing. Like, I am not willing to make such a stand that I'm not going to watch this movie that I like, or I'm not going to go to this restaurant, or I'm not going to watch this TV show that I really like. Is there a struggle there, do you think?
So I think for me, one of the really challenging things about the question you pose is there's no position outside of the society in which we operate. So I think misogyny and racism permeate almost all aspects of our culture. And so one of the reasons we focus so much on individual people is I think we'd like to pretend that it's just them, and if we get rid of them, we'll somehow fix the problem. That's not the case. We know that's not the case. So I'm in some cases less worried about our individual consumption decisions, about whether we watch this film or watch this thing on Netflix or go to this particular restaurant, than trying to change the baseline culture of how we operate, how we engage with each other as humans, and what we allow to pass. One of the most troubling things about all these allegations, the things that come out daily, are the assumption has just been no one's going to be held to account for these, right? And that's based on the reality that no one has been held to account for these. So if we can change that, if we can, people can know that if they encounter this kind of abuse, this kind of harassment, these kind of violations, that people will listen to them, that people will believe them, that HR departments actually do their jobs and hold people accountable, that would be a good baseline to change. But that's the sort of structural baseline we're trying to change, as opposed to individual consumption decisions. I think people can watch whatever they want to watch, go to whatever films they want to go to, and eat wherever they want. But at a baseline level, we need to change how we regard each other as human beings.
Yeah, I think it's freedom of choice. I mean, it's, you know, you choose what you want to do. I mean, we all make choices in how, and sometimes we vote with our dollar on the morality, if you will, of certain decisions. But just because that is an issue for me doesn't mean it should be for somebody else. And I feel we have to be very careful, because then you start going into restricting things for everybody just based on one group of people's response to how it is. And I think it's a slippery slope. You know, yeah, you want to hold these people accountable. But at the same time, you also have to be realistic. Okay, how are we going to do that?
Tiffany, you'd mentioned a little while ago about how, you know, maybe royalties from movies or shows that some of these folks who've been accused of improprieties goes to a charity or goes to something else. What would each of you like to see going forward, assuming that shows and movies of people who are accused of inappropriate behavior, in some cases criminally so, what would you like to see happen with money that is made from that, awards that are won from stuff like that? Like, how do we make this sort of a teachable moment and get some good coming out of this, as opposed to just, you know, glorifying artists who, as it turns out, were terrible people?
It was interesting. We had a show several years ago that focused, it was called Artillery, and it was art influenced by guns. And it was curated by an outside person, and the curator decided to include a piece by Gacy, you know, the mass murderer. What the victims did were, some of them purchased the work, or they somehow, somebody purchased the work, the money went toward victims, or some of them had a bonfire with it. You know, it just depends on what therapy needs to be done to help people, how they want to choose to rectify the situation. And I think going at them in the courts, I mean, making sure these people don't work with Weinstein again. Sorry, if you're going to work with him, you're going to get a backlash. And whether or not you want to do that, that's going to be your choice.
Matt, what do you think?
So I'll take a slightly different approach on this, focusing on Hollywood. I would say that the major studios need to invest heavily in having more women as directors for film and television. I was looking at UCLA. They put up a report every year on the sort of gender and racial dynamics of who's making the things that we watch. Only 15% of films are produced or directed by women, and only 30% of TV shows are produced and directed by women. I'm going to make a sweeping generalization that I think is largely true. All of the things we're seeing right now are not, we wouldn't see if we had women in positions of power, right? These are men behaving badly, behaving illegally. If we had equal numbers of women and men directing films, being in positions of power in studios, these things wouldn't happen the same way they're playing out right now. So while I'd love to see sort of funds created and directed direct to the victims, I think a broader change might be holding the studios to account and asking them to have real systems in place to make sure that they have appropriate gender representation of women in film and television.
Matt Delmont is the director of the School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies at ASU. We were also joined by Tiffany Farrell, curator of exhibitions at Mesa Contemporary Arts at Mesa Arts Center.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Still to come this hour, we'll meet two women who left the FLDS Church and are trying to help others doing the same thing.
But first, the next time you're in Mesa and you spot a fire truck, you may do a double take. In the effort to deal with budget challenges, the Mesa Fire and Medical Department is allowing select businesses to have a logo and a message on their fire trucks. There are restrictions, and the funds generated from the ads aren't expected to dramatically fix any shortfalls. But the city and the department definitely believe they're worth a try. To learn more, I'm joined by John Pombier. He's Mesa's assistant city manager who oversees police, fire, and medical. John, how did all this get started and lead to the fire truck sponsorships?
Last year, we talked to all of our departments, not just the fire department, about ways that they could find efficiencies so that we could provide the services at a high level at a lower cost, and ways that they could find revenue-generating opportunities. We do that almost every year, and so last year was no different than any other year in that respect. We were asking for a certain amount of cuts that they could offer up, and we were also asking for revenue-generating opportunities. So in the fire department's case, they were asked, just like every other department, I think the number, if you gave a straight 5%, was around $3.5 million. But we only ended up taking, I believe, $1.4 million from their budget.
And so this is a case of each department you're talking about was to come to you. So the fire department, with having some sort of edumercial or whatever we're going to call them on the side of trucks, that was something that they broached?
They brought us three or four different revenue-generating opportunities. That was one of the revenue-generating opportunities, was to take public service announcements and place them on the side of the fire trucks and see if we could get businesses in our community to support those positive messages to the community.
Had anything like this been done before in a similar sense in Mesa? And I don't mean on city-owned vehicles, but anything sort of similar, anything related to city-owned property or TV shows or anything like that?
You know, I'm not 100% sure what we do with Channel 11 in terms of advertising opportunities, but I will tell you that we've put positive public service announcements on the side of our solid waste trucks for years. So this is not something that's brand new to the city, and this was the idea to pair it with community partners to not only get their support for the message on the side of the trucks, but also to get them involved in the topic area. So we generally look to try to match up some of our community businesses with topics that are close to what they do, so there's an ongoing relationship to promote our attempts to train and provide better information to our citizens.
When it comes to the fire department, then, what are some that have gone into play already and some that may be on the docket?
You know, we look at things like messages like it's everyone's business to stop the spread of the flu, or watch your kids around water, stealing from that one. Looking at different things like, you know, don't drink and drive. Those are the types of messages we're going to put on the side of trucks, and then look for sponsors in those areas just to make sure that we're putting the positive message out there. So we're really looking at public service announcements that pertain somewhat to fire, but also have a community response to it. Obviously, our fire department responds to motor vehicle accidents. They respond to drownings. They respond to calls for medical around the flu. So those are all things that hit near to our business and are things that we like to give our citizens ideas on how to prevent those things.
And John, if all goes well, is there an amount of money the department is hoping to raise or expects to raise just from the ad specifically?
What we looked at originally was anywhere from, I believe it was $10,000 to $15,000 for a sponsorship, and that could be anywhere from 20 to 25 trucks. We don't know whether we'll get that much. We don't know whether we'll generate that much interest. But we're generally looking at it from a message standpoint, not as much a revenue generation standpoint, because in the grand scheme of things, even at its most, let's take 25 trucks at $10,000 each and do $250,000. That is not a large percentage of the fire department's budget.
Right.
We're looking at this more as a win-win for the community than we are a way to solve any types of budget issues that we have.
Now, we're a number of years clear of the Great Recession, but I know that cities and communities, county, state, still struggle with budgets. How is Mesa doing generally, do you think, as far as the budget goes?
I think generally we're holding our own, but you hit the nail on the head. We are seeing an increase in demand for services that probably outpaces the increase in revenues that we have. We are always looking for ways to be more efficient, because our ultimate goal is to provide a very high level of service to our citizens. And, you know, we can't continue to do that at the same price every year if the demand is outstripping our revenue generation.
Have you had any people who are just concerned, even with those ads, even with the ones that are respectful and associated with the department's mission? Because I think sometimes people see ads on anything, whether it's a basketball jersey or something else, and they tend to blanch a little bit at it.
I've not personally talked to anyone who was unhappy with what we've begun to do with the fire department. And I think that's part of the reason why we handled it in the way we did. We started with the Mesa Chamber of Commerce. They've been a great partner in this. And the first prototype was sponsored by the Mesa Chamber of Commerce. So we're trying to do this from a community basis. I don't know if they've gotten some complaints about it. We have not, to my knowledge, gotten any complaints about the actual messages on the side of this fire truck. And to be honest with you, we never got any real complaints about public service announcements on the side of our solid waste trucks. They were generally viewed in a positive manner because it's not out there to sell a product. It's not out there to advertise. It's just a public service announcement. And I'm not sure whether people even are going to look and see who the sponsoring person is of that. They're going to see the message first and foremost.
John Pombier is Assistant City Manager for the City of Mesa. John, good to talk with you. Thanks.
Thank you.
One of the interesting aspects about yesterday's highly contested Alabama Senate race was that the election was, at least in part, determined by black voters, especially black women. The demographic breakdown of the voters is telling. As for voters, for Democrat Doug Jones, 34% of white women voted for Jones, while 98% of black women did. The difference between white and black men in the vote overall was similar. 72% of white men voted for Republican Roy Moore, but just 6% of black men voted for that candidate. That's all according to the Washington Post exit poll. In a traditionally disenfranchised demographic and in a state with some of the strictest voter ID laws in the country, can the rest of the country extrapolate bigger lessons from the African-American turnout in Alabama? To hear more on that, I'm joined now by Cheryl Laird, an assistant professor of government and legal studies at Bowdoin College in Maine. Cheryl, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
How significant was the African-American vote in yesterday's special election?
Hugely significant. I think if we even see the aggregate numbers of a lot of the vote share that's going to Jones, when you disaggregate that, what you're going to find underneath there is that African-American voters are disproportionately driving the win that he was able to get there in Alabama.
Now, there was so much talk leading up to the election in the last week to 2 weeks about how Democrat Doug Jones really needed to boost African-American turnout. He needed those voters to show up and to vote for him, but mostly to show up. How do you think he was able to do that? Because clearly he got enough.
He did. And I think something to think about there is a lot of times politicians often make that statement, right? They'll say we need to get a particular demographic to turn out in high numbers, but don't often recognize the work that has to go into that. And I think this brings in a lot to think about targeted advertising and the need when you need a particular demographic to strongly turn out and be mobilized, not only work on the targeted advertising, the targeted efforts to get them to turn out, but what does that look like? And having a very good knowledge of what that is, or at least having consultants or people to inform you of what that would look like, is key. So from my read of what's gone on with the Jones campaign, they really did a lot of get out the vote efforts. They were very aware of the issues of voter suppression and the issues of voter ID laws within Alabama. They actively tried to counteract that. They targeted African-American voters the best that they could through Black institutions or Black media. They had endorsements and individuals who are prominent within the African-American politics come and speak in Alabama. They went to African-American churches, which is a very important space as well. And so their targeted efforts towards the Black community were important in that they were very thoughtful about what would be needed to get that demographic to turn out, and that those appeals need to be framed in particular ways, right? The necessity of the election itself, why it is important to that particular community. And I think even in that demonstration, then that also sets Jones up for his term and his office as a senator to really understand the needs of that population that were able to help him get the office.
When you look at what matters most, you talked about some of sort of the nuts and bolts of campaigning, targeted get out the vote efforts, targeted messaging. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how much that matters relative to some of the more in front of the scenes, for lack of a better word. You know, former President Obama recorded a robocall. Doug Jones had Senator Cory Booker with him in Alabama over the last couple of days. How do those two aspects sort of play off each other? And is one maybe more or less important than the other?
I would say that in a lot of ways, actually, people often don't emphasize the grassroots aspect to this, but I think that that is a big important thing there, right? Because big officials like Cory Booker or President Obama can come in and serve as influencers and endorsements, but a lot of the information that communities, particularly those like African-American community in Alabama that has a long history, right, of slavery as well as segregation and practices that have very much isolated those communities, what influences a lot of their political behavior is partially these endorsements from officials and leaders that they know beyond the state or their locality. But a major influencer will be those individuals that are around them, their social networks. And so a lot of my research, along with my colleague and co-author Ishmael White at George Washington University, we are thinking a lot about political norms and norms of the community around electoral politics, and particularly partisanship and how much partisanship matters to African Americans and the Democratic bloc voting that we see them do. But that in fact, what we see is that this is being shaped very largely by Black institutions at the local level. So the Black churches. So I read a report talking about people coming to the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Alabama to speak about the issues, the pastor and reverend at that church openly discussing the election, places of text messaging campaigns being sent in localities to communities to inform them about what was going on, local organizations organizing like travel to the polls, right? So how do we like strategically plan to ensure that everybody gets there at the same time? So a lot of that would require then for grassroots organizations, local organizations to have a read and a feel of the community, because even then when people from outside those communities may be coming in to assist with the election, they don't know where to go.
I'm sorry to cut you off. We're unfortunately going to have to leave it there. That's Cheryl Laird, Assistant Professor of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College. Cheryl, thank you.
Thank you. No problem.
The community of Short Creek on the Utah-Arizona border is best known for being home to the polygamous sect, the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or FLDS. But as more and more people leave the church, they also leave the support network and social structure that comes with it. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry reports on two women who left the church and are leading efforts to provide assistance to others doing the same. And a note, the story contains language that may be offensive to some.
When Shirley Draper left the FLDS Church 14 years ago, she was alone.
All of my family, all of my friends, all of my structure, my sense of belonging, my very identity was caught up in this community. And I literally had nothing on the outside. I had no resources. I had no money. I had no way to support me and my four kids, and two of whom are, you know, special needs.
She took her kids and left her husband and the rest of her family and moved to nearby St. George, Utah, about an hour away. But coming out of the FLDS Church comes with lots of challenges. Many people from Short Creek say the community faces high rates of poverty, substance abuse, and suicide. When Draper left, she had little money, no credit, and no rental history. And finding an apartment as a single mom without those things is really tough. But Draper says that social challenges and dealing with the stereotypes people have about polygamous communities is in some ways even more difficult.
I would be in Walmart looking around thinking, I wonder if one of these people would be my friend. You know, I wonder how I could fit in here. And I would turn around and find my cart full of condoms, which is the message that, you know, you plagues have too many kids and you've got to learn how to control yourselves. And then I'd be at the checkout and somebody would say, oh, is the government going to pay for this too? Because we know how you guys all out there are abusing the welfare system.
It took Shirley Draper about 5 years to feel settled in St. George, to establish a community, build her own identity, and have friends. And she found that others who left the church were coming to her asking for advice about how to navigate life outside the insular community, especially because many of the organizations working with those who had left the church were started by outsiders. Draper felt many of them were exploitative, making a public show of personal details.
When people would come to me and they're like, well, I can trust you because you're not going to, you know, trot me up on the Capitol steps and have a press conference with my face.
So Draper started working with Cherish Families, an organization that specializes in assisting those who have left polygamous or plural communities. One of its founders and all of its employees come from plural families. They work to connect people with resources, including mental health services. They also do cultural competency trainings for people who aren't as familiar with plural communities.
The word polygamy really is an epithet now. And that's a social construction, but it's hurled at the population, and the population doesn't believe it practices polygamy. It believes it practices plural marriage, and there is a distinction to the population.
And those distinctions can be the difference between someone feeling like they belong or not. Cherish Families also runs programs for those who have left the church and may be especially vulnerable to assault and abuse. They focus on healthy relationships and self-protection for women and girls. Leona Bateman also left and sees this as vitally important.
Every youth story that I've heard about getting raped or abused, the girls still think it's their fault. They think it's their fault because they left. They think it's their fault because they didn't obey their parents. They think these bad things happened to them because we're told our whole lives that if you leave, you're going to hell and bad things are going to happen to you. But bad things do start happening to you because you're experiencing a lot more things than being in a little tiny box.
Leona Bateman started her own organization called Creakers Foundation, often called Crickers Foundation by those in town. It focuses on providing peer support as well as mentoring and youth programs for those coping with leaving the church. Leona Bateman's son was kicked out and later committed suicide, something both Bateman and Draper say is common. When Bateman's son was first kicked out, she and her family didn't leave with him, and he was ostracized as an apostate. Processing that now is difficult.
When you're all secluded in the FLDS, it weren't all bad. Believe me, it's an easier lifestyle than what I'm living right now. Then you don't have to make any decisions. So if your son gets kicked out for doing something bad or whatever, you don't ever take the blame upon yourself. You think, oh, well, I was just doing what I was told, so the blame's on them. But the minute you feel empowered, you realize that every decision that you make, you're responsible for.
Bateman says creating spaces for support and sharing experiences has been very meaningful. While many of her programs are in person, she's also started Facebook groups for people to reconnect and tell their stories.
I've really realized that the storytelling is healing, and not only that, it brings us together. We have girls that have been kicked out of this town for 10 or 15 years that can go to this group, even if they're in New York, and reconnect and find their mothers and find their sisters.
Bateman hopes to channel her experiences into something positive, and in some ways sees this as an opportunity to make up for the past.
What we're going through now is nothing compared to what I watched my sisters and brothers go through that left. They had no contact with nobody. The world wasn't aware of what's going on, and we couldn't have anything to do with them. And this, in some ways, is my repentance. It's paying them back for all the people that, in some ways, I abandoned.
But now Bateman has returned, and she, Draper, and others are working to create a new vision for the community, one where no one feels alone. Sarah Ventry, KJZZ News, reporting from Short Creek.
And we've heard Sarah Ventry report on the community in Short Creek over the last several weeks. And she joins me in studio now. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
So you've reported on a lot of changes in Short Creek. What's next for the community?
Well, if you remember the first story in this series, it was about the very significant mayoral and city council election in Hilldale, which is on the Utah side of the community. Now, that election wound up being historic. And for the first time ever, three of the city councilors who were elected are non-FLDS. The mayor-elect is also, she's ex-FLDS and is a woman. So she's going to be the first woman to be mayor of either Colorado City or Hilldale. They are going to take office in January, on January 8th. And I had heard rumors from some that if any non-FLDS candidates were elected, the FLDS who are in office would leave their posts. Now, I should be clear, I asked the current mayor of Hilldale about that. He is FLDS, and he said he hadn't heard that at all. So it really is just a rumor. And so far, there's no reason to believe that the transition won't be smooth. But watching how the city councilors interact with one another is going to be really interesting. You know, FLDS church members are not supposed to speak to those who have left or were kicked out of the church. And starting in January, there's going to be a council comprised of both church and non-church members. So there definitely could be some tension.
Now, those are just some of the changes. What about changes that are coming besides the new mayor and city council?
Well, there's been a lot of change related to housing. So basically, at one time, the land in the community, it was communal, and it was owned by the financial arm of the church. Now, the land is being subdivided, and people have the opportunity to buy their own home and parcel of land. This makes a really huge difference for a lot of
things. So, for example, if you lived on a large piece of land with three other people and two of them weren't paying their taxes, that whole piece of land is affected because the taxes aren't paid up for that whole piece. But if the area is subdivided into smaller parcels, you're only responsible for yourself. So the land was subdivided in Hilldale first, and then just a couple of months, in the last couple of months, was divided for Colorado City. And this, like lots of things in the community, is even further complicated by religion. So FLDS members have been evicted from their homes in some cases because they refuse to pay an occupancy fee to live in the houses. When this happens, it means that there are fewer FLDS people in the community, which then affects the demographics, the elections, the politics, lots of things. And even just within the last hour, actually, Lyle Jeffs, who was the bishop of the community, was sentenced to almost 5 years in the food stamp fraud case and escaping from confinement.
That is big news. But what about on a more day-to-day level? Are there things that people in the community want to see change?
There are some serious infrastructure issues that need to be looked at. There is a part of the community on the Arizona side that does not even have safe drinking water. There are some people who think that the streets are in need of repair. And then people also have a lot of just aspirations for ways to improve things economically going forward. Industry in Short Creek is really limited. And a number of people told me that they want to take advantage of its location, which is not too far from a lot of the Southern Utah parks and, of course, the Grand Canyon. There's a sense also that there is an opportunity for tourism, so around these outdoor spaces, and even, you know, potentially an opportunity to capitalize on the unique history of the area and drawing in tourists who may not otherwise come up that way. And I should clarify, too, that the people who are telling me these things are all not FLDS.
And Sarah, to close, you spent a fair amount of time in Short Creek. It's a place that people have a lot of ideas about. Not many people go and visit. What was the biggest surprise for you about the community?
Honestly, it's how open so many people were. I am embarrassed now to say that I was pretty nervous the first couple of times I went up there. I had no idea what to expect. But really, I found a small town with admittedly a very specific history, but generally a small town where people were much more open to talk with me and share their stories than I expected. There are definitely still reminders all around that the town is home to the FLDS church. There are still buildings with high walls around them and really big houses. But there are also little restaurants and coffee shops and kids walking to and from school and exactly the kinds of things you'd expect in any rural community.
KJZZ Sarah Ventry. Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks, Steve.
You can hear all these stories in Sarah's series Short Creek Beyond FLDS, as well as see photos and hear voices from around the community by visiting kjzz.org/shortcreek.
In the gritty western Godless on Netflix, a tiny New Mexico town has been devastated by a mass casualty event in the local mine. A woman, twice widowed, tries to raise her son on unyielding land, and a band of 30 outlaws roam the region hunting for a traitor.
Let's all bow our heads and pray that Roy Good don't never show up here. But that if he does, none of you well-meaning souls, take him in. But you want to suffer like our Lord Jesus suffered for all of us.
That was Jeff Daniels' character, Frank Griffin, speaking to a captive audience inside a church.
If you watch Westerns, both classic Westerns and revisionist Westerns, you assume that gunfights are a daily occurrence, that everyone's an expert marksman, that the fastest draw always wins the day, and that's the story of the Wild West.
And that's Stephen Aaron, professor of history at UCLA. We turn to him to walk us through the real and mythical frontier.
And that metaphor of Wild West is one we continue to see being used in all sorts of ways and often misused.
So what was life in the Wild West really like?
I mean, on the one hand, the cataclysmic violence that opens in, I can be a spoiler here? The cataclysmic violence that opens the first episode and closes in the sort of classic Western formulation. One of the things it gets right in between is that it ascribes the truly horrific violence that sort of initiates the action in some sense is the mining accident that kills most of the men. That's something that I think too often Westerns have left out, but Western historians have recovered, showing that, in fact, if you want to look at the patterns of violence and death in the West, you are far more likely to die in an industrial accident, in a mine or a railroad, for example, than you would in a gunfight on a street.
For instance, he says, take the hero worship of cowboys. That wouldn't have happened without a certain pioneering president who happened to cement the values of the West through his image and writing.
Cowboys have a complicated mythic lineage. On the one hand, at least for a time, cowboys were seen as kind of not particularly savory characters, even in their sort of in their heyday moment in the 1870s and 1880s, where Godless focuses. Cowboys come to take on a sort of greater mythic significance and a sort of heroic role that then really it is the election of Teddy Roosevelt to the presidency that really catapults cowboys to a sort of new stature in the American and global imagination.
In some ways, the myth of the American West, or at least the movies about the West, can be distilled into little universal lessons. Life is hard and short. Persevere, achieve independence. But individualism wasn't the whole story, says Aaron, and that idea deserves another look.
You know, the myth of the West celebrates the rugged individualism of heroic male pioneers, white male pioneers. And I think recent histories of the American West have tended to turn that picture on its head and to suggest the importance that the federal government in particular played in shaping the conquest, the colonization, and then the consolidation of the West into the United States. The myth has, you know, plays out among sort of good guys and bad guys armed with guns dueling it out for whether civilization would triumph or not, and tends to leave out the vital role that government and government agencies played in shaping the development of the West. And that omission obviously has significant consequences, not only for how we think about the history of the American West, but how we also grapple with the West as it sits today, and the continuing tensions born of both dependence on the federal government and resentment of that overweening federal presence.
And along with government's ever-present influence on life in the West, as the title of Godless implies, or doesn't imply in this case, religion was key to life in the West. Or rather, it was part of a set of several keys.
The myth of the West suggests that the bringers of civilization had long also been the bringers of Christianity, and that these two missions were entwined with one another. That bringing civilization and bringing democracy was also tied to bringing Christianity. That gets complicated because the Christianity that's being brought initially is primarily Catholicism coming up from Mexico or from Spanish territory, which then is sort of mingling and meeting in the 1870s and 1880s with the Protestant missionary civilizing impulse, and then also entangled in this territory with the Mormon presence. So suddenly, simple kind of lines about who's bringing what to whom are not so clear-cut at all anymore.
Beautiful country, ain't it? Good book says prosperity is the path to godliness. But if God wanted men to be poor, he wouldn't have surrounded them with so much bounty.
Which good book are you referring to?
What adds actually a layer of complication that's a subtext in Godless is that this is also taking place on the edges of the Mormon terrain in Deseret. And the Mormon presence complicated all sorts of notions about democracy and religion because there were great fears, and one of the fundamentals that leads to a great deal of persecution of Latter-day Saints is the fear that they are trying to erect a theocracy within their territory in the American West. And Godless is sort of taking place in that sense, on the edges of the Mormon domain.
God? What God? Mister, you clearly don't know where you are. Look around. There ain't no higher up around here to watch over you and your youngins. This here's the paradise of the locust, the lizard, the snake. It's the land of the blade and the wrath. It's Godless country.
What Godless gets right, Professor Aaron says, is its many messy subplots and character backgrounds.
Which is one of the reasons why I think the American West in the 1870s and 1880s is such a fascinating place, not simply for its mythic wildness, but also for the ways in which it allows us to see what happens when all of these different peoples meet and mingle, and what emerges out of that convergence of peoples and cultures.
That was Stephen Aaron, professor of history at UCLA. His focus is on the frontiers and borderlands in North America. You're listening to The Show.
That's The Show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to The Show podcast.